Session number 12268, Mr. Charles Biedman, Reel 8.
Charles Biedman, Reel
8. At this end of the war, there's most men, including myself, felt restless. And quite a proportion of them took off for Tokyo, and they had nothing except a bit of money, no arms, although by this time some of us had Japanese swords, which they took off Japanese soldiers. They'd stop a tram and then make the soldiers take off their belts, which left them holding their trousers up. There's another visible means of support, and take the belts. And amazingly enough, I heard of no reprisals. And I myself came back without a sword, because on one occasion I stopped a general who was visiting a geisha house, which was near our camp, and asked him for his sword, and his face literally went green. And I quickly realised that if I asked him for the sword, he'd go home and commit harakiri. And so I apologised to him and handed him the sword back and said to him, if I were you, sir, I'd, you know, come out without it or get something you don't mind losing. But anyway, they took off, and again, I heard of nobody who ran into any trouble. While all this was happening, MacArthur was coming in very slowly, you know, with full armour, because he honestly didn't know what to expect. And among other things, he was looking for the son of one of his classmates, Lieutenant Chandler Baldwin. And before we left Moji, this lady flung a gold ring into my lap. And this may have been reciprocal, because I had asked her to have some cufflinks I'd kept hidden from our own men as well as the Japanese, and to keep them for this lad until he came of age. And when I looked at this gold ring, it was a very heavy ring with something like an opal stone, and it was a West Point graduation ring, and it had the owner's name engraved inside, which was Chandler Baldwin. So I thought, well, the least I could do is to get this back to him. I thought I probably would be close enough to one of the main army centres to be able to do this, but in actual fact, we didn't touch America except for New York coming in from Canada. And I wasn't going to leave this just within the army personnel, because I had enough experience of the services to know that it would never find a destination. So it came back to England with me, and I then, through the embassy, got in touch with them and found that this was indeed a West Point graduation ring, and that Chandler Baldwin had died 3 weeks before the war finished. He was on the last convoy that came out of the Philippines, and they were treated very badly indeed, because they were harassed night and day by submarines and aircraft. And they cut them off from all food and water, and the only way they'd get any drink was selling possessions. So he must have been in a dire state to have swapped his West Point ring for something to drink. And this lady who gave it to me probably obtained it from a seaman, and she motives probably were good, but I think she also probably realised that it was a highly dangerous thing to have in her possession, because if it was ever found, she would herself have been in lots of trouble. So back I am in England, and I tried to send the ring to America and can't, because there was an embargo then on sending gold out of the country. So So I went back again to the embassy, who eventually put me in touch with Colonel Carl Baldwin, who was Chandler Baldwin's father. And he was pleased to hear that I had this ring. And his wife got in touch with me. And eventually it was sent back through the American embassy by diplomatic pouch to General Vandenberg. And General Vandenberg saw that the ring was personally delivered to Mrs. Chandler. And once again, I've got a letter from Mrs. Chandler here, thanking me for sending this back. So if you'd like to see that, you can.
Yes, perhaps later on. That would be interesting. Yes, that's an interesting coincidence, isn't it? Yes. So your journey back then, you know, once having got to Nagasaki.
Yes. When we got to Nagasaki, the thing that amazed us was how clean the Navy personnel were. You know, they were sparkling. And the first thing they did for us was they put us through delousing and cleansing. So we got rid of all our old clothes, which they burnt, I would imagine. And then we were washed and then really, really covered with DDT against louse infection or anything else like that, you know. And came through initiated with sort of fresh kit. And it took us days to think that people could be so clean. And then we went on to an American aircraft carrier, which took us out to Okinawa. They separated the Americans from us, and they took them to their own quarters. And our beds were in what had been one of the main hangars on this aircraft carrier. And we took a few days to get through to Okinawa. I had to run ahead of a typhoon, which was present at the time. When we got to Okinawa, the only way we could get ashore was by the DUKWs. But there's still the aftermath of a storm meant that the waves were something in the region of about 15, 20 foot high. And the only way you could board them was by a boarding net. So you had a net flung over the sides of the ship. And you just went down on these nets, and then as the DUKWs came up, you just jumped, and several men sort of, you know, had their legs crushed, because it's no joke having a transport boat. I mean, they're about 80 foot long, crush up against the side of a ship. I went over quickly. Because I've always believed that if you've got to do a thing, you might as well get it over with. And when the thing came up, just jumped, and I was all right. And I was probably about the second in this boat. Went ashore. When we got ashore, it was quite astounding. They're very well organised, the Americans. And in the few months they'd been in Okinawa, I mean, they had six-lane highways and all the transport you can think of. And we used to say that the American Army used to issue everybody with a jeep and a pair of boots and masses and masses of vehicles. The Japanese were entrenched in Okinawa. They'd spent years digging fortifications and cementing and dynamiting everything through to make sort of powerful shelters. As far as the Americans are concerned, they took no notes at all. They didn't attempt to fight the Japanese at all. All they did was they sealed the entrances up with concrete. It just entombed them. And that was it. Finished. So they're quite ruthless. but it might have taken them months and months to wink these Japanese out. And then from there, we were flown to Manila in the Philippines. And that to some people was a perilous journey because they were in unlined huts, unlined planes. And in one or two instances, bomb bays opened and men were hurled down into the Pacific, you know. But again, with mass operations of this kind, you're going to get some accidents. These things are going to happen. And I can remember it was very cold in this plane because they were unlined. So we put on all the clothes we wore and sort of walked up and down, sort of stomping our arms, just to keep ourselves warm. When we got to the Philippines, again, the real sort of American efficiency, they had you checked and tabulated in something like about 20 minutes, and you stood and had your weight done, and while that was being done, your height was being taken, and you were tacked in both arms and given injections, and somebody else inspected your teeth. So they really got through sort of thousands of them in very fast time. And Manila was quite something, because supplies were flooding in from the Pacific. All the armaments and equipment and everything else was all going into Manila's centre. Well, coming in the rate it was coming in, there was no possibility of having any serious check-in on the thing. So service personnel were just selling it to the Philippines, who were avid to get hold of anything. And even in the camp we were in, cigarettes and stuff were ad lib, so you could go in and just help yourself to two or three, 200 packs, you know, just to take them out, etc. And if you walked out of the camp, I mean, there were people sort of queuing up to pay anything for them. And on one occasion, I was only there for a week. I got out quickly because of my initial being B, you know, I was always at the top of the list. But we went into Manila and we stopped a truck, a small truck, and it was had an American corporal, and we asked him for a lift to Manila, so he wouldn't get to this, and he said, you know, he found out who we were, and he said, well, he said, I've got one or two deliveries to make, and he said, out there, he said, I'll take you out in the town. So we said, well, just a minute, you know, we haven't got any money because our money hadn't come through, you know, there are four of us. He said, no problem. And he said, you know, there's a mass of money there. And he said, if they leave me here for another few months, he said, no, I'll never work again in my life. Because he said, you know, it's just everything. He said, I'm just negotiating how to sell a Jeep, you know. But it just piled in and piled in and piled in just like that. And we went into this nightclub and the entrance fee there was $100 Philippine, which I think there was the equivalent of about $50. And the place was packed. And, of course, there was all these American service people, and all this sort of wealth all being pulled and confined, plus the, you know, enormous euphoria of the end of the war. So the thing was there. And then we left the Philippines and went on to one of the Liberty ships. We were going back to San Francisco. They looked after us very well. In fact, they even used to get a film show every night, and you had men sitting in front of the screen and men sitting behind the screen. you could see both ways, and they were lovely nights because, I mean, you're in the middle of the Pacific, and balmy nights. We didn't have any bad weather at all, and the way they fed us was quite astounding because it was excellent food, but you used to go into the messes and there was no chairs or tables. There were simply some shelves around the wall, and you collected your food, which was always very hot indeed. And there were, being a Liberty ship, there were no portholes at all, so you nearly ran water, and all you'd go down in just a pair of shorts and have this lovely food, which you had as quickly as possible got out. So they used to feed these thousands of men in about two sessions, you know, no problems at all. And my impression always, the Americans, is that they are tremendous organisers. They really can get through. We didn't eventually go to San Francisco because one of the American fleets was coming in, and they then diverted us up north. And eventually we went to Canada to Victoria, which is on Vancouver Island in Canada. And when we came in, The noise was fantastic. You know, the whole town stopped working, and every ship, and there were a lot of ships there, blew off steam. In fact, I met commander of a corvette, and he said, you know, I just blew myself out of steam. And there was noise coming from the men on the boats, and men and people down below, and they were throwing up sort of food and flowers, and we were raining down coins and stuff on them, because we were the first in. And they'd been very close to the war. And then the town just opened up its whole hospitality to us. And it was nearly impossible to spend any money at all, because you go into the shop and they was just paid for. Or you went and had your hair cut. And the barber, you say to the barber, how much is that? And you say, well, the gentleman over there's paid for you. And he says, a pity you do, because I was going to pay for it myself. It just went like that. The first day we were there, as I say, we were restless, and this restless stuck with me for some months afterwards. And there were guards, Canadian guards, around patrolling the periphery of the camp. And one of my friends said to one of the guards, you know, is there any way of getting out of here? He said, well, he said, you know, the wire's pretty strong. He said, I reckon it'll hold your weight. So that was enough for us, and off we went. They were keeping us confined because they wanted to check on us medically, etc., and get our records right. But anyway, we went off into town and found ourselves a service club. And from then on, people were making sort of parties from us. And one particular chap in my regiment met up with a Canadian lass, I don't think I ever saw him back in camp again. And for myself, after a few days, I was walking in Victoria, and I met an ex-girlfriend of mine who had married a Canadian officer. And he'd got injured in Arnhem, so they'd sent him back, and he was in charge of a repat camp. So he got me transferred across to his camp, and from then on I was virtually a free agent. All I had to do was report in once a week, you know, and just to find everything was all right. They introduced me to some English people who had a lovely little residence up on the mountain called the Malahat, which was a few miles outside of Victoria. So I spent a very pleasant month with them in Canada. And then eventually after that, we entrained right across Canada to New York. A lot of it was quite a boring journey because, I mean, you get mile after mile after mile after mile through the prairies with nothing much there. And I've still got lots of sort of good wishes from the mayors of towns en route as we came across, and eventually went into a camp in New York, which had previously been occupied by German prisoners of war, and it was certainly once again a very efficient camp. And from there on into the Queen Mary, which could take thousands of people, and we had sort of a very comfortable cabin and nice pleasant journey sort of back home. And one thing of sort of interest was there were 20 nurses aboard with 3,000 men, and they attempted our dance, but I had to give it up. It just did not work out. And back again, and were somewhat surprised when we landed back in England to meet up with the austerity. Because, you know, this is just in the aftermath of the war, but we'd come across, you know, with Americans and Canadians who were still quite affluent, you know, etc. And it was quite suddenly this sort of hit, you know. Do you want me to go on from there?
We're saying about the reception, particularly when you arrived
in Victoria.
In Victoria, yes. What was your reception like in Britain?
Well, this is of interest too. I mean, you went into a camp. To start with, they didn't put through customs or anything at all. You could have bought in bags of gold bars, as far as that was concerned. That was it. The army camp was an army camp, and as I say, it sort of rather struck us that suddenly we're down to austerity again. And then off I went. Well, because of Manishla, I was always away quickly, you know, little bees, etc. When I came back to Clacton, they knew that prisoners of war were coming back, but I was the only one that came out of the train. So there were hundreds there, and, you know, just me. Of course, your family are pleased to see you, but it's adjustment even then, because you've been away for years. And so, you know, my brothers and sisters had taken some odd things about and utilised them, etc. So the place didn't seem the same, and I found it very difficult indeed to settle. Very difficult. In fact, I went up to see my friends up in Scotland, Dr. Barclay and John Levy and people I'd seen, and I just did not want to settle at all. But you gradually, you know, get into things at all, and get back sort of taking up the bits of your life.
Did people understand, do you think, you know, the sort of experience you'd had in Japan? Was it
very difficult? Extraordinarily difficult. To start with, I mean, most people don't want to talk about it. And then it's so much outside the experience that it's there. The army have been pretty good about it. This FIPA organisation are excellent.
What did the army do for you when you got back? You know, I was wondering in the way of, did you have counselling? Was there anyone?
No. This is quite strange, because what I wanted to do when I got back was just go back to study and give myself a sort of full medical qualification. And I had an interview in Cambridge. This chap that interviewed me said to me, "Are you qualified?" And I said, "Yes." "And can you earn your living?" And I said, "Yes." Then he said, "In my opinion, there are other people who deserve our assistance more than you do." So I thanked him. And I thought, well, that's it. You know, he had a bit limp sort of handshake. And I thought, well, that's it. I'll just make my own way. And then later on, when I tried to get some premises to start manufacturing in London, somebody at GLC said, "You know, were you manufacturing for the war?" And I said, "No." "And were you manufacturing during the war?" And I said, "No." And they said, "Then I'm afraid we can't do anything for you." Well, fortunately, I had a good solicitor, you know, and so we overcome that. But it's a funny sort of, you know, it's an attitude, because once it's over, and that's it. You know, they can't sort of understand or find it difficult. I've even a medical board I attended about 18 months ago, I suppose, and there was a lady there from the DHSS as well as a surgeon and a lawyer and an army man. And the only person who was antagonistic was this DHSS. She was late 30s, I would think. And her attitude was, "You picked a bit of a nuisance." You know, it sort of goes on and goes on and goes on. And how do you make them understand? It's sort of there. And thinking back in retrospect, I'm pleased I had the experience, because it's sort of fine education and it, at least you survive and you come through it. So the thing is there, wasted years, well, yes and no. My life might have taken a different course, but I'm sure it assisted too. I'm sure it did, in your sort of mental attitudes.
Have you had any compensation, though, for what happened to your eyes?
Well, I do get a 30% sort of war pension for my eyes. Although I had to fight fairly hard for that. Because they couldn't understand, you know. I mean, I can see the trouble is they don't coordinate very easily. They're not unsympathetic. Although I met one ophthalmologist I didn't like, but he was a Czech national, and I arrived late through no fault of my own. There was just traffic hold-ups, but he was cross because he sort of kept his lunch waiting, and his final report was that my sight was excellent, you know, nothing wrong with it. But I've told one or two boards I've been on to that if they gave every ex-prisoner war pension, they wouldn't be far wrong, because a lot of the privations were far worse than they're ever going to know. Again, I find that they're pretty fine men. They really are, because I suppose in a sense they have to be to survive. So they achieved a lot. And as I think I begin to tell you, at this moment of time, there's about five countries are going at Japan, led by the Canadians, who's said to have sort of quite a brilliant team now. Attlee and his crown, and his crowd sort of signed a document absolving the Japanese completely at the end of the war, and I think all men, though some never claimed, you got about £73, which is the Japanese assets that were around there. And this was signed in sort of full and final compensation. Well, a lot of people haven't agreed to this over the years, and one crowd have really gone at it. They're saying to the Japanese, well, you did cause a lot of dire trouble, and the attitude was wrong, and so the least you can do is to try to compensate some of these men or some of their dependents. And if you don't, we're going to start publishing this stuff all the time, you know. And Japan could afford it, so that's the sort of stage it's at.
How do you feel about that, Charles? What is your own view on this matter?
I think a lot of these men should be compensated. It doesn't sort of matter to me personally, because, you know, I've always been sort of self-reliant, I can look after my own income. I ran quite a successful firm of manufacturing chemists, and I don't think you can be a successful managing director without knowing something about economics and finance, investments, you know. So the thing is there, and I don't rely upon any sort of handouts. But I mean, some of the stories are so dire, some of the things that did happen, that they should be punished. I mean, for example, the Germans have made a lot of reparations for what they did, and I think in the main they've been sort of quite pleased to do it for people. Otherwise, things sort of passes over and sort of nobody thinks very much. As you know, I haven't got any particular animosity towards the Japanese, but I do know a lot of people have, and I can understand it. There's a lady who was a matron of a hospital in Sumatra, and she was interned and eventually became a commandant of a camp of 700 women. She's just doing one thing. She said, next time, she said, if it ever happens again, she said, I'll make sure that I'm commandant of 700 men. You know, but she told me in the early days, they just took out about 24 women and just shot them. Nothing, no reason at all. No reason at all. Just to sort of perhaps cow the others, you know. And when she came out, she weighed four stone six. And she was 35. And amazing enough, married after that, and she's got three children, and she says they're all quite brilliant. No problems. The eldest is a consultant, and her daughter is a specialised nurse.